On Sunday, John Berendt broke a record. His book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, became the longest-running bestseller ever on the New York Times hardcover bestseller list. The book begins as a portrait of the eccentrics he met in Savannah, Georgia, and turns into a true-life murder mystery. Last year, Clint Eastwood made a film adaptation. This is Midnight's 187th week on the Times bestseller list. The previous nonfiction record holder at 186 weeks was Norman Vincent Peale's Power of Positive Thinking, published in 1952. The fiction record holder at 178 weeks was Lloyd Douglas's The Robe, published in 1942. I asked John Berendt if he's ever read those books.
I remember when I was a teenager in high school, I worked at the Economy Bookstore in Syracuse, New York. I'd go there after school, and that was in the 50s, and that was when The Power of Positive Thinking was a bestseller, and I remember scanning it. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's because Norman Vincent Peale was a minister, it was very much tied to the Bible and Jesus Christ, but it was the same sort of book you see at the very top of the paperback bestseller list now, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff.
Right.
And it's all small stuff.
So what impression did that give you of what it meant to be a bestseller?
I thought bestsellers really were appealed to people's lives directly or to their beliefs. I mean, The Robe, again, is a semi-religious story. So that's what I thought of bestsellers then.
Have you ever broken a record before?
No, I haven't. I hadn't thought about it either. No, I haven't.
Did you do anything to celebrate?
I did not, but my friends are giving me a party in New York on May 3rd, so I'm looking forward to that.
Now, what if you're off the bestseller list on May 3rd? How would you feel?
Oh, I don't think it would. Well, if funny, it'll be. I'm sure I'll get a lot of ribbing. March 3rd, I'm sorry, March 3rd.
Then you'll be fine. You're safe.
I should be all right, because we're all right now till the 22nd of February, and it looks pretty good. The book is number 5, so... but if I were to fall off, I would be the butt of a lot of ribbing, I'm sure.
Now, do you chart where you are every week? Like, uh-oh, this week I'm number 5 and not number 4, it's falling.
Of course I do. I'll tell you, it would be very hard to take this, to be blasé about being on the bestseller list, at least for your first book. I mean, it is actually my first book, and it's, of course, the first time I was on the list. I'm hoping to do a second book and a third, and if those get on the list, I probably won't feel the same. But, I didn't expect the book to be a bestseller to begin with. I was hoping to get critical approval and even possibly critical acclaim. But it never occurred to me that this book would be a bestseller. In fact, friends would ask me as I was writing it, are you writing a bestseller? And I'd say, are you kidding? You've read chapters. How could it be?
Now, when you signed the contract for this book, you weren't expecting it to be a bestseller. It was your first book. If you knew that it was going to sell as well as it did, would you have changed things in your contract?
Not at all. Uh-huh. The contract is a traditional one. I think it's more or less boilerplate. There's nothing about that. I'll tell you what I would have done. We wouldn't have sold the movie quite so quickly. We sold the movie the week before it became a bestseller. Now, if somebody had told us, wait, hold on a little bit, we might have waited a little longer. It would have made some difference, but when the movie finally did come out, directed by Clint Eastwood, it made a huge difference in sales. And so what we might not have picked up when we sold the rights, we gained when the movie came out.
Did many publishers turn down Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil when you were first sending it around?
No, but something worse happened.
What?
I had an agent when I started in 1985. I took 7 years to write it. This was a major New York agent. And when I was finished, I sent her the completed manuscript. Before then, we did not look for a contract. I didn't get an advance. I did it all on my own. And the agent read it and sent it back to me and said, it was fun to read, but it's too local. I can't handle it. I don't think a publisher would be interested in taking a chance on a book like this in this market. It's an agent I had known for a long time. She's one of the best agents in New York, best known. And I wasn't devastated, as I might have been if I'd been new to the business of publishing. I'd been in magazines for 25 years. I knew the book was publishable. That's what I knew. I knew it was good, well-written, fun to read, compelling, rich, all those things. But I did not know it would be a commercial success. I thought it would be at least modestly successful. So I was angry. I knew it was a publishable book. So I simply took it to another agent who didn't know anything about my previous history with this other agent. And I said, I've got a book, it's all finished. And this agent read it and loved it and showed it to four publishers, all of whom bid on it, and Random House outbid the others. So no publisher turned it down, but and this is a rare thing. Agents don't generally turn a book down.
John, what did you like best and least about the film adaptation of your book? Putting you on the spot a little bit.
What I liked best was that it sold a million copies of my book, I guess I could say that. Now, that doesn't sound sincere. Let's see. What I liked least, I guess, were the unnecessary changes. In the book, I'm a narrator who's a passive narrator. I see things. I'm not part of the story. And the people in Hollywood told me, that works for the book. It won't work for a movie. The people in the audience want to root for the narrator. And since the narrator will be the main character, we've got to make him more active. At first, they wanted me to be not a journalist, not an Esquire writer, but a lawyer who comes down from New York for some reason and then takes over the murder case of Jim Williams, which I thought was an absolutely awful idea. And they didn't use that. Clint Eastwood vetoed that after they actually did a script based on that. What they did do was create love interest for the narrator, which was not well realized in the movie. It didn't work at all. It was unnecessary. They changed the story to go from four trials to one. Mm-hmm. And this was, everybody in Hollywood thought that was just the way to go, perfect. And there wasn't any debate about it either. And early on, I'd been asked to write the script, and when I heard these particular things coming down, I decided it wasn't for me. I don't think I'd have done it anyway, because I know that translating a book as dense as mine into a movie would be an operation that would change the whole thing. And the book worked well, and I had no assurances that a script that I wrote for the movies would at all be successful. So I stayed out of it. Those, I think, were the things. What I liked best about it were some of the portrayals. I thought that Kevin Spacey as Jim Williams was excellent.
Oh, he's always great.
Yes. He did a very good job. Mm-hmm. He even put, I described Jim Williams' eyes in the very first sentence of the book because they were remarkable. They were all black. There was no colored iris. It was all black and white.
I think you describe his eyes as they take everything in, but they give nothing out, something along those
lines. Yes, it's like the tinted windows of a sleek limousine. He could see out, but you couldn't see in. Yeah. And that was the kind of thing, opaqueness to his eyes. And what Kevin Spacey did was he went out and got contact lenses that made his eyes look black.
Huh.
The pupils looked like he had pupils and whites and nothing else.
Right.
So that was good. And I liked John Cusack. He was criticized, I think, unfairly. But the role was difficult. It wasn't structured in a way that would, it was easy to do. And I thought he did a good job. I liked Clint Eastwood personally very much. I went down there for the first couple of days of shooting. And, of course, Savannah was on the moon because Clint Eastwood was there, and they were very sweet about it, and they were thrilled and excited, and there were huge crowds would form, and they'd stand respectfully a few, yards away behind the police barricades. What else I liked most? Certain scenic shots about the movie I liked a lot. I loved the portrayal of Sonny Siler, the lawyer, by Jack Thompson, who's an Australian, in fact. Did a beautiful job. The Lady Chablis, the black drag queen in my book, played herself, I thought, very well. They expanded her role, I thought, too much, but she handled it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And certain things for me really looked just right vis-a-vis the, I know what these things should look like, the places, the events. And so that's what I liked about the movie.
My guest is John Berendt, author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Berendt is my guest, and his book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, just broke the record for the book longest on the bestseller list of the New York Times, 187 weeks. I want you to read from the very beginning of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. This is from, like, the bottom of page one into page two, and it's a nice description of Jim Williams, the guy who either murdered his lover or killed him in self-defense, and This is just talking about his furnishings and his money and how he uses it.
Williams was smoking a King Edward cigarillo. What I enjoy most, he said, is living like an aristocrat without the burden of having to be one. Blue bloods are so inbred and weak, all those generations of importance and grandeur to live up to. No wonder they lack ambition. I don't envy them. It's only the trappings of aristocracy that I find worthwhile, The fine furniture, the paintings, the silver, the very things they have to sell when the money runs out, and it always does. Then all they're left with is their lovely manners. He spoke in a drawl as soft as velvet. The walls of his house were hung with portraits of European and American aristocrats by Gainsborough, Hudson, Reynolds, Whistler. The provenance of his possessions traced back to dukes and duchesses, kings, queens, czars, emperors, and dictators. Anyhow, he said, royalty is better. Williams tapped a cigar ash into a silver ashtray. A dark gray tiger cat climbed up and settled in his lap. He stroked it gently. I know I'm apt to give the wrong impression living the way I do, but I'm not trying to fool anyone. Years ago, I was showing a group of visitors through the house, and I noticed one man giving his wife the high sign. I saw him mouth the words, old money. The man was David Howard, the world's leading expert on armorial Chinese porcelain. I took him aside afterwards and said, Mr. Howard, I was born in Gordon, Georgia. That's a little town near Macon. The biggest thing in Gordon is the chalk mine. My father was a barber, and my mother worked as a secretary for the mine. My money, what there is of it, it's about 11 years old. Well, the man was completely taken aback. You know what made me think you were from an old family, he said, apart from the portraits and the antiques? Those chairs over there. The needlework on the covers is unraveling. New money would mend it right away. Old money would leave it just as it is. I know that, I told him. Some of my best customers are old money.
Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil is, in a way, a book about a gallery of eccentrics. Do you usually gravitate to eccentrics?
Love eccentrics. And I don't know why. They're more dramatic. As you know, and I'm not defensive about it at all. Somebody, one critic, not meaning to criticize, but just observing, said that I had cherry-picked my characters, which is a sweet way of putting it. I am drawn to eccentric people. These are the creative people. These are the people who create their own lives there. There are works of art, you know, living works of art. And that's the way, that's an important difference between Northerners and Southerners. In the North, we tend to shy away from somebody who's a little bit different. In the South, they love people who are different. They encourage people to be different and eccentric. They talk about them. They love to talk about them. And I have a feeling, and that's my theory, why Southerners... per square person, why there are more eccentrics in the South than anywhere else, is that they love them. They talk about them, and people who are eccentric know they're appreciated, if only because they're giving people something to talk about, and that encourages them to be even more outrageous in their eccentricities.
Does every eccentric now want you to immortalize them in a book?
I don't know about that, but I'll say that when I was in Savannah and people knew I was writing a book, people wanted desperately to be in the book, and they would audition for me. They would sort of trot across my field of vision, behaving in odd ways. But what they had to come, the problem for them was that I was actually living in Savannah. I wasn't just there for a weekend or for 2 weeks at a time to get information. So if the act was really an act, it would subside eventually, and the real person would emerge, and often enough that person was good enough to make it into the book.
So everybody knew you were there to write.
They knew I was there to write. And I was the guy who was there in town writing a book about Savannah. And everyone thought that was the silliest idea they'd ever heard of. Who'd ever want to read a book about us, they said. And I said, well, everything has to happen somewhere. And in fact, do you think I should write about Eatonton, Georgia, I said. And people would say, well, that'd be even stupider. And I said, well, that's where The Color Purple happened. Everything has to happen somewhere. Oh, well, I see your point, they'd say.
Do you have a next book yet, or are you still shopping for an idea?
Well, I've been shopping since this book came out. I found a wonderful story in Venice, in Italy, that is not, I don't think it's a book-length story, but it's a wonderful one I'm going to do. I spent a lot of time researching it several months over in Venice. But I have a feeling it's too short. It's not complex enough to be a book, but I'm not going to make it any longer than it should be. So it'll be like a novella in length. But I do want to write another book. There have been a lot of distractions since this one came out.
Do you have a lot of publishers pitching you ideas for a next book that they think will be just perfect for you?
No, I don't.
Really?
No.
I'm shocked.
I don't. I don't know why. I would expect they don't. They probably feel that I'll stumble on something or something will find me and they may not feel they can think of the right thing. I don't know, but I have not had a lot of people. I do get letters and telephone calls from strangers suggesting ideas, and I welcome them because you never know where the real idea is going to come from.
I just murdered my boyfriend. Come do a book about it.
Well, let me know more about it.
No, I mean, I'm not saying I did.
I mean, that's what I would say. Tell me more.
Right. Right. Well, congratulations on your success and on breaking the record on the New York Times bestseller list.
Thank you
for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Berendt is the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which this week became the longest-running bestseller ever on the New York Times hardcover list.